Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and also the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. We have a special post-Thanksgiving and post-Black Friday episode planned for you. First up, we have Nancy Reynolds. She is a Walmart worker who started a petition drive to get Walmart to give its workers a 10% discount on food, like many other employers do, so that its workers would have a better chance of being able to afford to eat on wages that are not a living wage. We also speak with Michelle Chen, a contributing writer at The Nation magazine and also a co-producer of Belabored, one of my favorite podcasts produced by Dissent magazine. We speak with her a little bit about the Fight for 15 movement, which was started 3 years ago around Black Friday. And we also have Scott Rodd. He is a freelance writer and photographer whose work focuses on the poorest towns in America. And we speak with him about what it's like to focus as a journalist on poverty and how it can require you to live in poverty. And finally, we wrap up with The Weekly Worst with Alan Pike from Think Progress. You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross. 3 years after the Fight for 15 movement began, many workers at big box stores still don't make nearly enough to make ends meet. But by organizing collectively, Fight for 15 activists have changed the conversation and achieved some big victories, with many states and cities raising their minimum wages. But where is the movement headed next? To find out, we're joined by Nancy Reynolds, who works as a cashier at a Walmart in Florida. She started a petition to ask Walmart, the world's most profitable corporation, to give its employees a 10% discount on all food, like other retailers such as Target and Whole Foods. Her petition has almost 15,000 signatures. Welcome to the program, Nancy.
Hi.
So I'm curious, what spurred you to start this petition? Have you done any activism like this in the past?
I've been with our Walmart for 3 years now, and I was talking with the people with our Walmart and with my coworkers, and everybody would agreed that the 10% discount on all food all year would benefit them, and it'd also benefit Walmart because they do more shopping at Walmart, and it would help their budgets because we, right now, everybody has to search for sales to be able to eat. And even in the past, I have gone to the churches to supplement my food so that I could have enough to eat. Wages are not enough. We do need the 15 in full, and basically the 10% discount would help us so much, and if they give it to us from November 19th through the first of the year, why can't they do it all year round?
And so have you heard anything from management so far? I know that you've amassed thousands of signatures, so that seems like it would at least get their attention.
Well, my assistant managers and store managers the store manager couldn't say much, but the assistant managers all said they agree with me that it would help, and it is a win-win situation.
So do you know what is standing in the way of this actually being implemented yet? Is this something that corporate has to weigh in on?
Corporate has to agree on it, and they have to implement it.
So this is something, though, that largely the employees are behind, management more or less sounds like they think it's a good idea. So what are your next steps in making sure that this petition and this movement goes forward?
Well, I took my petition in to my manager, my store manager, and asked her to please get that to Doug McMillan at corporate office so that and several others across the country. With our Walmart, they also carry that petition in, and we are seeing to it that Doug McMillan gets this petition, so hopefully he can make a decision on it, and he'll do so in a hurry.
Well, you'll have to keep us posted on that. And I know that this isn't the only issue that you all are focused on in your location. Did you work on Thanksgiving or Black Friday?
Yes, I work both days.
So how did that impact how you spent the holidays with your family?
Well, I wound up having my Thanksgiving on Wednesday. I was off Wednesday, so I had mine on Wednesday.
And so what does your schedule typically look like? I know that it can be complicated sometimes to plan your schedules around family obligations or even dealing with medical appointments. Can you walk us through a bit what scheduling looks like for you?
Okay. I pretty much have a set days off. I had to work around, and it took me – I've been there almost 8 years, and it took me until about 4 years ago to get – this situated so I could make my doctor's appointments, but so I have set days off for scheduling my doctor's appointments. But a lot of the people, they don't, so they give them one day here and one day there, and it may be a day, they may need a day in between for a doctor's appointment and can't get it. But my schedule goes anywhere from 9 o'clock in the morning. I can go in one day, 9 to 1. I only work 4 hours a day due to the fact that I'm retired. I can go in, but I am diabetic, so I need a sort of an even schedule. One day, 9 to 1. The next day, 3 to 7. The next day, 10 to 2. Then I can go to get my body straight, 3 days of 9 to 1, and then all of a sudden, 5 to 9. And it really keeps the body and your mind. I have to check my schedule every day to find out when I'm going to be there.
And so how does this impact your health regimen? You mentioned that you're diabetic, but that you're maybe a more fortunate than some of your coworkers by having a little bit more of a predictable schedule. But still, since it does vary, how does this impact how you approach your health care?
Okay. It has impacted me to the point where my diabetes is still not under control like it should be, even though I try to stay on my diet and try to eat regularly. My doctor has been having to continue to adjust my medications. I'm on insulin as well as metformin, and the insulin is, I used to take it at night, but because my schedule was so strange, he switched it and has me taking it in the mornings now, which it's an insulin that should be taken at night. And we're checking to see how that will go for 4 months. And so, I mean, my doctor even said, they won't work with you, we'll have to work with you because we got to get this straight. So that's the problem for a lot of people. And a lot of the people I work with, they're young people and they have children. It's hard to get daycare or childcare when you've got these type of schedules.
And so is there any work that you're involved with to try and persuade your management to make sure that people have more predictable schedules?
Yes, our Walmart has been doing this. We've been petitioning them. I have been on strike several times for the Fight for 15, and the consistent schedules and full-time for those that want it. And I plan to continue battling until my health gets so bad that I cannot do anymore, because I'm really not totally battling for myself. I'm battling for the young people.
And you mentioned the Fight for 15 again. What would it mean for your family and for your coworkers if you were able to increase your pay?
Okay. If I could get a car that would run, I just had to have my car towed. I have an old car and the water pump went. I have been babying it. I can't even get it out of the shop until Thursday because that's payday. There's a lot of people that are the same way. And where I live, the bus service doesn't run on Sunday. So If I have to work on Sunday, that's taxi ride. And I have to walk a block and a half to two blocks to get to a bus. So, and there's a lot of people that are in my position. They could honestly afford a car. We could honestly afford to take a vacation once in a while other than just take time off from work and sit at home. People could be able to afford food. They could afford clothes for their children. And they could just have a better life. They could. We live in a resort area, and people can't even take their children to the beach a lot of times because they can't afford the gas.
And how has different government programs such as nutrition assistance played a role in helping people out, given the fact that they aren't paid fair wages?
Okay. There's a lot of them that do get food stamps. I do get food stamps, but because of my retirement, which is not very much, it pays my rent, and I basically live on what I make at Walmart, I get $16 a month in food stamps. There's a lot of my coworkers, they make $5 to $10 too much to get food stamps. So basically, that doesn't help us, but we do have a lot of churches around that do give food. You can go stand in the food lines and get supplement food. It may not be all the special foods, but it's basic foods, and it keeps the hunger away. A lot of people live on ramen noodles. So basically the 15 and a full time and the would make it so that we could afford decent food and afford a movie for our kids once in a while and, you know, just have a life other than just try to subsist, you know. I survived. That's it.
You know, and I'm struck by everything you're saying because I was listening to some politicians just talking about how people need to work hard, and we hear this a lot about how Americans just need to work hard and that if we raise the minimum wage that it will kill jobs. What would you hope that politicians could understand that you and your coworkers are going through?
I would like all of the politicians to live on minimum wage only for at least 6 months and see how well they can do. Because then it will be an eye-opener to them. We had some politicians try it here for a week, and they failed after 2 days. They couldn't do it. So now they're getting behind that raising the minimum wage. But raising the minimum wage will not get rid of jobs. Mainly because if the people will have more to spend, so the businesses will need more employees. So it's basically a trickle down. Wages they've been pretty stagnant for many years. I'm almost 69 years old, and I've seen how they've done. Everything else has gone up, and food has gone up, housing has gone up, and it's with the raising of the minimum wage, I don't see where it should cause anything to go up, because right now my rent is $600 a month. It just went up. And it's an apartment that I have lived in others and in other towns where the rent is not quite that high. Rent that I'm in a lower cost apartment, and it's a decent apartment. The rent has gone up. It's tripled. People, when the wages don't go up and your rent goes up, what happens? You wind up living in your car or in a tent because you can't afford rent. And so therefore, the raising of the minimum wage will not lose jobs because the people, if they've got the money, got a little extra, they're going to spend it, and that's going to help the economy.
And back to some of the efforts that you're part of through Our Walmart, I know that you haven't fully been able to participate in the Fast for 15 given on the fact that you're diabetic, but can you talk a bit about what some of your coworkers are doing as a part of this Fast for 15 protest?
Yes, some of my coworkers went on the 15-day fast where they had nothing but liquids. They lived on broth and I think Gatorade for 15 days. There were some that fasted for 1 to 2 days at a time because they were trying to work and they couldn't fast and work at the same time. But on their days off, they would fast. Some of them did a partial fast like what I did. I gave up something that I love, you know, one of my little treats for the 15 days. Some of them just... They did what they could because it's so near and dear to our heart. We want to let them know because some of my coworkers fast every day anyway during their time of work for 8 hours. They don't have the money to buy lunch. I've actually loaned money to people because with no idea that I'd get it back, which I haven't. But give them a couple of dollars so that they could buy a little something to eat because they wouldn't be eating then, and they had ramen noodles for supper.
You know, another thing that some people or politicians will think about is, well, if that job's not paying well, then maybe workers should find another place to work. You know, how would you respond to that?
Well, show me another job that pays more. Show me a job that's hiring. There are no jobs out there. All of the jobs are paying the same thing, minimum wage and below. McDonald's and such, the fast food industry, they cut. My daughter worked for them. My daughter, my grandson, and my granddaughter all worked McDonald's at one time. They cut their to Wendy's, and they were making minimum wage, and they cut their hours to 15 hours a week. Now show me someone that can live on that. So you can't really do that. But with our the schedules were all over, so they couldn't work two jobs. Just like Walmart, with the way my schedule goes up and down, I could not find another job if I wanted to, and neither can my coworkers. There's some that do have other jobs, but they were grandfathered in. They've been there a long time, and they have like I did, they managed to get a set schedule. You know, basically certain days off, so they work at another job on their days off. And they have no life because all they do is work.
So what comes next for you all in terms of this movement to raise the minimum wage, to get the discounts? You're doing a lot of different things to improve job quality. What are the next steps for you all?
To continue doing what we're doing, and we get together and we have brainstorm together. We have phone calls once a week. It's conference calls, you know, all around from people from all over the country. And we brainstorm and decide collectively what are we going to do next? What would be the best idea? We take ideas from everyone. So we just are planning to continue. We're continuing the fight. We're not giving up. And we're out there. And we want to get it out to the public. Because before our Walmart started, everybody thought that Walmart was so great, that all of these fast foods were paying so great. They thought it was a good job. And now, with all of this going on, the public is becoming more and more aware of what is going on in the workplaces. So that's what we've got to do. We've got to get the public to give pressure to these corporations. And Walmart is one of the biggest. I mean, they $16 billion profit in 1 year. Excuse me. They could help. They could raise their wages a little bit. They could give us a few extra things.
Nancy Reynolds, a cashier at a Walmart in Florida, who started a petition to get Walmart to give their employees a 10% discount on food. Thank you so much for joining the program, and good luck on your efforts.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. We just spoke with Nancy Reynolds, who works as a cashier at a Walmart in Florida, about her poor working conditions at Walmart, as well as her activism as a member of the Fight for 15 movement. To learn more about what's going on the ground and where Fight for 15 is today, 3 years after its birth, we're joined by Michelle Chen. She's a contributing writer to The Nation magazine, as well as Dissent magazine. She's associate editor at Culture Strike. She's also a co-producer of Asia Pacific Forum on Pacifica's WBAI, as well as Dissent's Belabored podcast. Michelle, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks.
So, Michelle, we wanted to have you on for this, our Thanksgiving-focused episode, because we just passed the third anniversary of the original Fast Food Forward protests, which, as we all know, spawned the viral hashtag Fight for 15. And these efforts have focused on workers who have traditionally been outside the scope of organizing activities. Why do you think that unions have made this shift in the time since the birth of the Fight for 15?
Well, just to offer a little bit of background, I mean, the Fight for 15, in the sense of it being a hashtag and kind of a viral movement, I mean, the organizing has been sort of bottom-lined by the SEIU, and it's been done in coalition with community groups, and I think it kind of flows out of a longer legacy of unions partnering with community groups and sort of ad hoc worker organizations that do not sit within the standard NLRA kind of union definition in the sense that they're not legally branded as unions, but they're nonetheless part of the labor movement. So what they've been able to do with a lot of this low-wage worker organizing, and they've kind of branded it as Fight for 15 now, is that they've been able to sort of mobilize workers from a lot of different sectors under this single unifying banner of a demand for, you know, $15 an hour, which, while certainly not exorbitant, is a lot closer to a living wage than what these workers earn currently. So it's kind of a combination of a rallying cry as well as a mass mobilization effort. And while SEIU is behind it, you've seen a lot of other organized labor groups as well as different types of community groups, a lot of faith-based groups rallying behind it as well. So it's become kind of a very accessible movement and campaign, as well as something that's kind of flexible enough so that while it does get union support, it is not specifically tied to any one organizing campaign and certainly not to any single unionization drive. A lot of these workers are not even really talking about setting up unions yet. They're basically just vying for, you know, livable wages and something other than substandard working conditions. Well, and I think it just speaks to this, the level of inequality across the country right now, and the fact that so few people actually belong to unions.
And in the 3 years since the birth of this movement, what do you consider to be some of the chief victories that it has achieved?
Well, you could sort of think about victories in terms of whether or not higher wages are being achieved, which kind of gets at the sort of the numerical aspect of the Fight for 15. And we have seen some token raises on the part of large retailers, so that's come voluntarily from the private sector. But I think one of the biggest wage gains has been in minimum wage initiatives and adding momentum to some of these government interventions. You've seen significant raises in minimum wages in various jurisdictions across the country. They've been doing this through ballot referenda, and they've also been doing it through legislation. And in New York, you've seen something that's kind of innovative, which is a wage board mechanism. And under new, sort of a quirk of New York law, the governor can sort of commission a board of experts to set a wage rate for a specific sector of workers across the state. And he recently did this to raise the wages of tipped workers in New York. And the most recent initiative, which is seen as kind of the one of the biggest victories yet for the Fight for 15,
specifically for fast food workers, was a statewide fast food worker minimum wage of $15. There are a lot of exceptions carved into that, and you know, if you ask one of the local experts on labor law, they'll probably tell you that it doesn't really cover all fast food workers, and different things are exempt from it. But by and large, it's the biggest raise specifically for fast food workers that we've seen so far. But the other half of the Fight for 15, of course, is they're not just demanding higher wages, but they're also demanding the right to unionize. And that has seen less of a victory. If you want to count just being able to organize and turn out workers writ large as a step forward in that direction, then certainly, we've seen some of the largest mass rallies of low-wage workers, union and non-union, in various parts of the country, over the past 3 years that we've seen in a very long time, hasn't necessarily translated into concrete unionizing drives. And to be frank, I mean, I don't know that it's really viable to pursue that as a political goal just yet. However, I mean, if we get out of the sort of specific sort of legal definition of union as a framework, we can see that it's definitely a boost for the labor movement as a whole.
You wrote a piece recently for The Nation entitled "Almost Half of All America's Workers Make Less Than $15 an Hour," which even just the title was probably staggering to a lot of your readers. And in that piece, you made the point that there are concrete victories, but that there may also be symbolic victories of this movement. What did you mean by that?
Well, there are concrete victories in the sense that if, there is a meaningful minimum wage increase in, say, Los Angeles, which just went to, a $15 minimum wage, or Seattle, for that matter. I mean, that will impact a lot of workers. But I think more than that, it sort of sets a higher bar for what low-wage worker organizing can achieve. I think if you think back to 3 years ago, just think about the reaction to the headline, right? I mean, we're shocked that that high a proportion of the American workforce is making under 15 an hour. But I think 3 years ago, if you said, hey, I think fast food workers should be making $15 an hour, I think you would have gotten a very different reaction from your average person in the street. I mean, some of them might have actually laughed at that, right? Some people might have scoffed at the idea that a low-wage worker who is seen as doing something that doesn't require an education, doing something that isn't seen as a serious job, doing something that has historically, stereotypically been done by kind of a marginal labor force that isn't doing it to sustain a family, right? I mean, that was the stereotype around a lot of these low-wage jobs. And I think 3 years ago, the attitude of the public would have been very different. Now, $15 means something, right? And $15 is achievable in the eyes of a lot of low-wage workers out there. I don't think many people who are seriously in the labor movement have any illusion that this will be the nationwide minimum wage anytime soon. I mean, we're still pretty down there in terms of the federal minimum wage, but just the fact that a major city, right, could have a minimum wage that says, a standard worker in this area, in a city, in a high-cost city like Seattle, should not fall below a wage floor of $15 an hour. Whether they're waiting tables or whether they're, taking care of your children, right? I mean, that's a minimum decent standard that we should set for people. And I think that mindset has a much wider reach than just the number of people directly affected. I mean, honestly, like, there are a lot of people the number of people making the actual minimum wage right now is a pretty small percentage of the workforce. But nonetheless, just the fact that the minimum wage sets a bare minimum that we have in mind when we think about low-wage workers, the closer that gets to $15 an hour, the closer we can get to starting to think about what it means to make a livable wage in today's economy.
I mean, there seems to be a parallel between the inadequacy of the federal minimum wage in terms of capturing what low-wage work really is, and the inadequacy of the official poverty measure in capturing what poverty and hardship really are.
Yeah, and I think what might be shocking to many people about the nearly half of all American workers falling below $15 an hour is that You know, many people don't even really work for hourly wages anymore, right? Or they're cobbling together a bunch of part-time jobs, and we don't even really have a workforce structure in which a large portion of the workforce can think about, like, well, I do the 40-hour grind, and this is what my paycheck comes out, like, on a consistent basis, right? I mean, many people have, like, their work lives are so tattered and kind of pieced together from multiple sources that we don't really have a clear idea of what it takes, what someone should be making per hour. And I think going along with what you were saying about the poverty measure, I think what some you know, scholars and think tanks are doing now is they're actually thinking about what a livable, what an hourly living wage should be in a city, let's say, right? And in New York, it might be upwards of $20 an hour. And we might think, what? Like, compare that to our current federal minimum wage. But the thing is, like, that's how far things have gotten in terms of just the cost of living rising way above and beyond what people are struggling to make. And it becomes even more real when you think about many people say, you know, don't work 40 hours a week, right? Many people just work part-time, or they work with erratic schedules, and they might get 0 hours 1 week and 30 hours the next. And so just the very instability of income, I think, should push us beyond looking at just what people are making per hour, per se.
And my last question for you while we have you with us today is, it's notable the sort of coincidence of timing between the Fight for 15 movement and the Black Lives Matter movement. Do you feel that there are lessons that the two movements can learn from each other? And where do you hope that Fight for 15 goes next?
Yeah, I mean, I think there you actually see direct intersections between some of the Fight for 15 protests and some of the Black Lives Matter protests. You know, the rallies were coinciding, and I believe, you know, some of the actions for Black Friday have kind of intersected and kind of harmonized with the call for the Fight for 15, and a part of that is the simple demographics. I mean, Blacks are disproportionately affected by low wages. They're disproportionately affected by low household assets. The wealth gap, the racial wealth gap, is really, you know, the wealth gap in America in many respects. And so it certainly makes sense that with Black Lives Matter comes a call for broad-based economic justice as well. I think the Fight for 15 has also really kind of managed to braid together the strands of social justice and economic justice in new ways. So, you know, yes, you know, it is just kind of a slogan in many ways, but I think that it kind of operates like a Rorschach in that it becomes kind of a vessel for carrying forward a lot of messages about social inequality. And I think inequality in general is something, is an overarching framework that that low-wage worker struggles and that racial justice struggles can kind of unite under. And in terms of where the Fight for 15 goes next, I think that's, you know, up for the labor movement and, you know, all of its offshoots to determine. But I think it's probably going to go become even more sort of widespread in terms of the number of sectors that it affects. And, you know, we started out just thinking about fast food workers, but, you know, if we can get some wage justice for fast food workers, then why not child care workers? Why not home care workers? Why not adjuncts? Why not people who may not even work for hourly wages, right? I mean, I think the Fight for 15, I think, will ultimately go as far as we're willing to take it in terms of thinking not just about a specific number, but in terms of thinking about what it means to have a real livelihood in this day and age. And I think that the discussion on wages and the discussion on things like the minimum wage and social welfare have really become detached from a broader debate about what social equity really means in terms of economics in this country.
Michelle Chen, a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and also co-producer of Belabored, a podcast produced by Dissent magazine. Thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. With me is Scott Rodd. He's a freelance writer and photographer whose work has appeared in Think Progress, Salon, and The Washington Post, among other publications. His writing includes a series of essays on the poorest towns in America. Scott, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me on, Rebecca.
So give us a sense of what types of stories you've written on as part of this series.
Well, the series sought out stories of individuals who, as you said, were living in some of the poorest towns in America. And these were stories from young and old, people in different circumstances, people who essentially just trying to gauge the diverse experiences of what it means to be living in poverty in America, trying to capture what that complex image looks like.
But of course, there's a real diversity of experiences that make up what it means to be poor. As we often discuss on this show, 4 out of 5 Americans will experience at least 1 year of significant economic insecurity at some point during their lives. So I have to be honest, one question I had to ask after having read several of the pieces in your series is, do you ever worry that focusing on concentrated poverty in places like Appalachia or the South risks reinforcing the myth that poverty is somehow something that happens to so-called other people?
I think you raise a great point. I think there is a risk there. First, I think it's important to note that this project dealt with the 1%, and not the 1% that we typically talk about when we talk about inequality, but the 1% at the very bottom. And the fact is, many of these communities have been battling poverty for a long time. But as you note, focusing on communities that are in the South, that are in Appalachia, there is a risk of reinforcing some of the stereotypes about poverty that we have and othering poor people. It's a very dangerous thing to do. But one of the primary ways that this happens, I think, is when poverty is described and understood in broad stroke terms. When the human dimension of poverty in these communities goes ignored. After working on this project for nearly a year, I came to the conclusion that rural poverty in Appalachia and throughout the South is fundamentally misunderstood. I think most people have an association of maybe Lyndon Johnson declaring the war on poverty on the steps of a dilapidated home, or a soot-covered farmer maybe, barely scraping by. But in reality, poverty in these areas has evolved over time, and it's more complex than people realize. And that includes myself when I first started with this project. And I think southern and rural poverty are largely terms of convenience, and they tend to lump the individual experiences of poverty under these convenient banners.
So have you thought about what's next for you in this series and whether you might go cover areas that are not typically associated with poverty, like, say, San Francisco or the Midwest?
Absolutely. I've definitely thought about where to go from here. My work covering poverty certainly isn't over. I would be more than happy to branch out from the areas that I covered here, which very much focused on the South and Appalachia, and go into more urban areas, go into the West, on the West Coast and the Midwest, and seek out communities that are also, you know, enduring poverty. I think one of the challenges, you know, as a freelance writer especially, is getting publications to support and fund these sorts of projects. I mean, to speak very frankly, writing about poverty, it's not exactly the sexiest issue. But, you know, when going to publications to try to support these sorts of projects, it can be a challenge. I mean, you know, and this isn't necessarily new. I mean, with the work that eventually was developed into Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, that was originally rejected as an article that covered poverty, and eventually it was developed into a book. But, you know, these sorts of issues for writers who want to cover these topics isn't new. But it's kind of a continuing battle to see if publications will bite on this, will, you know, accept the fact that there is an imperative, there is this sort of, there should be a push to cover these very pressing issues. You know, like I said, even if it isn't the sexiest of topics, there's a real imperative for it.
Well, as you've mentioned, it can be a battle to get media outlets to care about poverty and to want to print stories and articles on poverty. I'm going to borrow a phrase from Barbara Ehrenreich, the founder of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project and the author of Nickel and Dimed. She has said on numerous occasions that in order to cover poverty as a journalist, you have to live in poverty. Has that been your experience trying to cover this beat?
Well, this isn't something that I've talked to many people about aside from close friends. But while I was traveling to these towns, I was sleeping in my car. I was eating fast food on the road. I had raised money through a Kickstarter campaign, and it was a very small sum considering the scope of the project that I was trying to take on. It barely covered, you know, food and gas. And as a recent college graduate, I really didn't have much money to take on this project, you know, and, you know, live lavishly along the way. And it was one of the more interesting experiences personally, one that I don't explore too much in the essays because I wanted the essays to focus on people who were living in these towns that had very few opportunities. But there was one moment that it may have been one of the most memorable moments of the trip. I was talking to someone in the town that I went to in Tennessee, Jamestown, Tennessee. And I was sitting there at a counter at a diner, and I was talking to him, and I mentioned that I was there because his town was one of the poorest in the country. And he was both fascinated by that but slightly unsettled. And, you know, we were talking about my experience traveling to these towns, and he said, you know, where have you been staying? What have you been doing? And I was open with him, and I said, you know, I've had to kind of stay where I could. You know, I've slept in my car a handful of nights, and there, my camera was sitting on the counter, and he took it and he spun it so that the lens was facing me. And it was just an incredible moment where I had to think to myself, you know, what's the difference between myself and some of these people that I'm talking to? And it made me realize that even though I was out there and sleeping in my car, you know, eating cheap food along the way, I was doing that because I was able to do that. Because ultimately, I was coming from a position of privilege. I mean, I grew up in a middle-class town, but I had this car that my mom let me use. I had a college education that my parents helped pay for. Not all of it, but helped me. I grew up in a town with a great school system. All of these things gave me the opportunity to say, you know, instead of working at a restaurant or wine bar where I'm making pretty good money, I'm going to drop that and I'm going to go travel around. And ultimately, I'm going to come back home where I can stay there if I want and there will be opportunities. So I agree. I absolutely agree with what Barbara said, that in order to cover poverty, a lot of times you have to live in poverty as well. The main distinction that I experienced and that the conclusion that I drew was, you know, for a lot of us who have the privilege to be able to write about these things, who have the time and who have the resources, we often have the opportunities to then step out of it. We have that privilege. A lot of the people that I talked to along the way on this project, they didn't have those opportunities and those privileges. That was a very eye-opening moment for me.
And my last question for you, what do you hope that readers take away from your series?
There are a few obvious ones. You know, like I said before, I would hope that people see the complexity of Southern poverty and Appalachian poverty, that it's not this one monolithic thing, that people who are in these towns have different experiences and have unique sorts of encounters with what poverty means for them and for their families. And I would say, moreover, as a result of that, my goal is for these essays to be an almost a kind of empathy booster shot, you know, for readers. You know, the people that I interviewed in these towns, even though they're living in dire poverty, they're very much like most Americans. I mean, they have the same interests, the same passions, values, and goals as just about everyone else in this country. So my hope is that when readers are reading through these essays, you know, they see familiar faces in the people that I talk to. They see friends, they see family. They see even themselves in these stories. And from there, my hope is that, you know, readers will confront what that means about how they view poverty.
Scott Rodd, freelance writer and photographer covering the poorest towns in America, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Rebecca, thanks for having me on.
And we're back. It's time for the weekly-ish worst. Alan Pike is in studio. I'm not going to pretend I can't see him like I usually do.
Hi, Tracy, Rebecca.
Tracy, I'm not asking you, is Alan here? He's just
Alan,
here.
I think Alan is here. That's
hi,
sitting
Tracy.
Next to me.
I'm here.
And we're back with the weekly worst, which is a segment when Alan, our friend from Think Progress, brings in three horrible news stories related to poverty, and we vote on which one is the worst.
And as he likes to say, it's not that they were horrible stories. They were hopefully well-written. It's the content.
The content.
There
the subject
go.
Matter
horrible.
Described
yes.
therein.
This is this segment is not an attack
That's the
on
hope.
Writers.
That's the hope.
Or Think Progress.
Yes.
All right. First up, in Wisconsin, there are 15,000 people who've already lost food stamps thanks to Governor Scott Walker's decision to reinstate work rules for the program prematurely. Unemployment rates are too high and job opportunities too scarce to require the toughest versions of work requirements for the program in 14 of Wisconsin's counties, according to the federal government. But rather than waive the rules in those counties until economic conditions rebound, Walker went ahead and reimposed the rules statewide. And in just 3 months since that change took effect, already 15,000 people have lost their food stamps. And charity officials, food charities in the state are warning newspapers that they're pretty sure they're going to run out of food.
And so that's I'm glad you brought up that last bit, because people usually point to churches or food banks as being the ones that should be filling the gaps in people's incomes and in any, you know, subsequent food that they need. But obviously, this is just pointing out how this is a horrible policy. The moment you said Scott Walker, I cast a vote in my head, because he's usually the weekly worst. I probably have to hear the rest of the stories. But
I think that was a challenge for what might be the rest of the stories.
But this
be.
Just has his office responded to?
No, I mean, well, this is what they want, right? This
right,
is for
right,
them.
But
for them,
have
this
they
is a feature, not a bug.
To the ramifications that.
I don't know. To be honest, I don't know if they've addressed it publicly. I do know that the way this is supposed to work, the federal government tells you these are the places in the country. They do this every year, every fall for the coming fiscal year. These are the places in the country where either the unemployment rate's too high or the number of people seeking work is too far out of whack with the number of jobs readily available in the area. And they don't entirely suspend the connection between food stamps and people seeking work. They just suspend the strictest version of those rules that require you to work, I think it's 80 hours a month, work or seek work or enter job training for 80 hours a month. They suspend those when the job market can't support that sort of hard and fast hourly requirement. And a lot of states that have been eager to sort of, with Republican leadership, who've been eager to push people off of support systems sort of proactively, in other places they've at least sort of acknowledged, okay, but these three counties, we're going to leave the waivers in place for now because the unemployment rate is too high or whatever. And they haven't done that in Wisconsin, and it's already, in again, just 3 months, 15,000 people. That's in a state of less than 6 million.
I'm glad you unpacked how it works, but to be clear, it's not, you can't satisfy the work requirements by looking for work. No matter how hard you are looking for work, if you're unsuccessful, if you can't find a job, you won't be able to meet those work requirements, and so you will go hungry. It is this really perverse and kind of horribly counterproductive policy where people who are most in need of food assistance because they are desperately looking for work but can't find a job, those people end up getting pushed off of nutrition assistance because they can't find a job.
Right.
Exactly. Cruel and stupid, as Alex Lawson would say.
I don't know how any news story could get worse than that, but why don't you
damn
try?
It, I should have done that in third. I did this wrong.
When
I did this all wrong.
When it's Scott Walker, it has
I'm
to
sorry.
Come in third. But let's see. Okay, what's the next one?
All right. Well, next is Walmart.
Okay.
So we got a pretty good character,
and
right?
On this episode, we had a Walmart worker, so this
will
be an interesting story to hear.
Things are looking up.
Well, so Walmart is warning the city of Desert Hot Springs, California, against raising its local minimum wage. The company's saying it'll back out of a store. Well, they're not out and out saying that. They're saying they'll have to reevaluate their next move if I think it's a 10-20 hourly minimum wage floor. Gets adopted by the city council, and they've been planning to open a store there that they say would employ about 300 people. The company even put a full page ad in one of the local newspapers attacking the minimum wage hike about a week ago. And this is a pattern for Walmart. They've done this in Chicago. They did this in D.C. I remember about a year ago, and that's especially annoying given that part of their business model is predicated on paying wages so low that their workers have to enroll on public benefits programs. And so, in effect, taxpayers, public dollars, are subsidizing Walmart's profits because they pay people so little. And then when governments try to do something about that, they sort of they play hardball.
Yeah,
nice city you got here. Shame
worker,
if nobody built a Walmart in it.
The worker that we had on was talking about how she often has to lend her colleagues money because they can't afford to get lunch during the day. So
Not that she can afford to be lending anyone money.
Exactly. Right. And she talked about that she's, has diabetes and, living on nothing. She's has to work extremely hard to maintain her health. And there's a lot of ramifications to this. It's not just about people wanting to get, more pay than is necessary. Like, these people are barely getting by. And even with a minimum wage floor of 10-20, was it?
Yeah, I think it's...
That's not even going to be enough. So
it's still way short of
minimum
of a living wage. Yeah. Is this the woman who's asking Walmart to extend their 10% employee discount on groceries year round?
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
Exactly.
She's a badass. She is.
I was on
a press call with her about the fasting that the workers
that's a bunch of workers
were doing
for 15. That's
15
what she was talking about.
Exactly. Before.
Well, I have to say, Alan, I thought you know this by now, but we have a strict policy on Talk Poverty Radio. We only let you on the air if you are a badass.
Badasses only.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So what is the third and final story?
All right. Third is the retail companies that forced workers to come in on Thanksgiving Day itself don't have a whole lot to show for it. I think we talked about this a week ago, or maybe 2 weeks ago, that there are a couple of companies, including Kmart and The Gap and Sports Authority and Macy's and Target and Walmart and a couple of others, that were planning to actually open on Thanksgiving Day, not just on really early on Black Friday, that they're going to open up that evening or in some cases even afternoon. But we now have sales numbers in for Thanksgiving and Black Friday both. So a couple things. First, overall sales for the 2 days combined were down about 1.5% compared to last year. And second, the 11 companies that opened their doors on the holiday itself took in just $1.8 billion in revenue in that time on the holiday. That's obviously a lot of money for you or me, but it's tiny compared to the $10.4 billion that shoppers spent in physical stores on Black Friday itself without needing anybody to skip their sweet potato pie and come man a cash register.
And not just skip their sweet potato pie, glib as I know you're trying to be, right? I mean, part of what made us so angry 2 weeks ago when we talked about Kmart, it's not just about opening, right? Some of these businesses actually decided not just to stay open on Thanksgiving and to screw their workers in that way, but to not even give them notice of what their schedules were going to be in advance. So this kind of schedule unpredictability that we talk about periodically on this show that is afflicting low-wage workers in particular and has become the new way of the low-wage economy and has enabled employers to basically suck every last drop of productivity out of their workers, or so it would seem, because it's about making sure that they can plug them in like cogs in a wheel when whenever it's profitable for them,
right,
is really kind of grinding them into the floor. And it is so especially heartless around the holidays. So not only did they not give people, Kmart, give people notice of whether they were going to be working so they could plan and be with their families, but not only did they stay open, but they also didn't even make all that much money from it.
Right.
So just unbelievable.
It's useless.
People were sort of chasing their own tails in a way that doesn't seem really to be worth it.
All right. So now we have to vote. And I'm gonna stick with the vote that I stated at the very top of this segment. I'm gonna stay
Bold.
With Scott Walker, also because, I mean, the attacks on the safety net are extremely frustrating, and I feel like it's something that goes through all three stories. You know, the Walmart worker that I spoke to earlier, that's reflected in the story that we heard from Alan. You know, these workers don't have much money, and I think that it's important that we really, I guess, fight against the attacks that Scott Walker and others who are misclassifying what food stamps and the broader safety net does for people. I mean, ideally, we're going to be paying people more, but this is an important part of fixing our economy, that we have a safety net for people to fall back on so that they don't fall deeper into poverty when they fall on hard times. So I don't like you, Scott Walker. I'm voting for you.
It's hard to vote against Scott Walker, I have to say, not in an altogether bold statement there. But I mean, because, you know, making people hungrier isn't going to help them find a job faster,
not
right? So it's just, this is one of my pet peeves. I think I have to vote for Walmart, though, right? You know, I mean, I suppose if there's anyone you can feel confident
about
in voting against
over,
Scott Walker,
yeah,
I think Walmart might be it.
I mean, he is holding a town hostage.
But to be the biggest beneficiaries of keeping wages low, right, and then to just sell self-servingly oppose policy that would enable people to actually put food on the table and support their families and get ahead, all because it just makes their bottom line fatter. It is as heartless and as just kind of evil, capitalistic, you know, I'm picturing Alan with like horns going out of his head right now and like sneering with a monocle.
I'm both glib and a capitalist devil?
No, just because I feel like you do good
what
impressions.
What the hell did I do to you?
That would be your...
All right, maybe I think now you
somebody's not getting a holiday
vote
card.
On my side.
Was I gonna before?
No.
Do you cast the tiebreaker or make it a three-way
tie? My handwriting
tie?
Is no, Wisconsin. No, Scott
Woo!
Walker. Of course. I think he was gonna vote
with you until you called him the devil.
I'm calling him the devil. He just does such good impersonations.
True, he does.
I feel like I've said this before on the show, but the reason I'm voting for this Wisconsin thing is specifically that even if you entertain the logic that animates the sort of hard-hearted approach to safety net programs that's underlying something like reinstating work requirements before the government says that they're really appropriate numerically, statistically. It doesn't make any... Your argument is we need to bring people back into self-sufficiency. We need to encourage people to get off the dole and back onto their own 2 feet. How is somebody supposed to do that if they can't get a job? I mean, Rebecca said it very, very well a moment ago, so I won't go on and on, but it doesn't make any sense even on its own terms as a policy choice. And yet, 15,000 people just in the first 3 months, we don't know how many more, probably another 15,000 in 3 months, already have lost their food stamps.
It only works if you have a Fox News conception of what poverty looks
like. Exactly. So
sure,
Scott Walker
live your life without
is
ever
the reigning champ
people.
Weekly worst. And we're going to end it there. Thank you so much, Alan Pike of Think Progress. We'll have to have you back again next
Pleasure
week.
Pleasure as always.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can listen on Thursdays at 4 p.m. East, 1 p.m. West on the WEACT Radio Network.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. Don't forget to rate us and leave us a review, and we'll be sure to shout out some of our loyal listeners on the air. You can also feel free to pitch us on some segment ideas via Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or by emailing us at info@talkpoverty.org.
We'll see you next week.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handle. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And they got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money.
money for the food and health care, the schools and bus fare. You can't pay the rent without the U.S. right there. With shackles on my hands and toes, they got a brother moving slow, but my soul is determined to go. I want freedom. Freedom. Now I don't know where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom. What we talking?